And now Clay Mitchell, who is the incoming clerk of the nominating committee, will introduce Alan Chinnan.
Thank you, Carol. I probably should have had Mary do some energy readjustment on my brain before I got up here, but I didn't. So I'm going to have to wing it. I read many fairy stories while I was a young student, and usually when I should have been reading some of my English assignments or something else. And I enjoyed all of them immensely. And I often impatiently skimmed to the ending where the prince on a gallant white stallion rode into the distant horizon with the princess cuddled in his arms. And it never occurred to me that there was any more to the story than just that. After all, wasn't everybody young and beautiful then? And didn't we all have such an ending in store for us? Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald movies proved it to me, you know. Later, it slowly dawned on me that there's a greater depth to the stories than I had naively believed. And this was recently emphasized for me with smashing impact, I have to really add, when I read three of the books by Dr. Alan Chinnan, our plenary speaker for the conference this year. In them, he adroitly reveals the multi-level internal and outward world levels of meaning and comprehension for adults. And some of his interpretations are so prescient that I felt as if he had written about me. So I've been looking forward to his being here because I'm excited about the possibilities of new discoveries about myself. But I have to add truthfully, it is with some trepidation that I realize I may not be ready for some of the discoveries he might turn over. Dr. Alan Chinnan grew up in Hawaii in both Buddhist and Christian traditions. He earned degrees in biology and philosophy at Stanford University, and he continued studies there in medical school. He trained in psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and he currently has a private practice. He's also an associate clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco. He's the author of four books and the co-editor of a textbook of transpersonal psychology and psychiatry and psychology. I'm confident that in sharing his journey with us, we're going to have a provocative and spiritually stimulating conference. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Dr. Alan Chinnan to the conference. Alan?
Yes. This is always on, so if you want to have a private conversation, get away from it.
Just that switch.
There's no switch, it's all at home. There's water there. And you can walk around, as you see. You can walk around, just don't get away with those little white things. And then if people have questions, we usually take the mic out.
Well, I'm delighted to be here and happy. You actually can't imagine how happy I am to be here because I almost didn't get here due to a small geographical problem I had. You can't hear in the back? How about now? Is it a little better? Testing. A little too loud? How about now? Of course, you could always do what our president said, read my lips. But I almost didn't get here because I had a geographical lapse and booked a flight to Philadelphia, thinking it was half an hour from this place. You should see me on a backpacking trip. Hopefully, I'm better navigating in the inner world. Well, looking at all the interest groups and topics, it certainly looks like this would be a memorable weekend. And I thought I'd start off by an overview of what I'll be talking about in the four talks. As Clay mentioned, I'll be addressing stories that leave off where the prince and princess ride off into the sunset. These stories tell what really happened then, when the princess wants a divorce. Maybe I should use this one. How about this? Where was I? This is midlife. What really happens in the ever after when the princess wants a divorce and the prince is downsized after his kingdom is absorbed by a larger one? You can't hear? Okay. Well, I suppose ancient stories and modern technology don't mix too well. The topic I'll be talking about tonight will be stories, fairy tales that are specifically about men and women at midlife and the issues that both men and women face and the interactions, which can be very interesting at times. Some of the themes that come out are role reversal. To quote a famous storyteller, the high will be laid low and the low will be raised high, and these middle tales clearly show that, as well as meeting the shadow, as was mentioned earlier. Most importantly, though, they also show a road to healing and the discovery of a deep new center of renewal. Then tomorrow afternoon, I'll be talking about men's stories and focusing on men's spirituality. I'd focus on men because they have been relatively neglected as far as recent writing. With the women's movement, there have been lots of exploration and recovery of women's spirituality, and men's has been somewhat neglected, I think because it's usually associated with being patriarchal. But as we shall see, these stories reveal that actually there's a deeper, older masculine spirituality, which is the shaman trickster, who appears perhaps 40,000 years ago in cave paintings, whereas patriarchs and warriors aren't around until about 8,000 years ago. These stories are long and hilarious, as you'll see. The third talk on Sunday is called The Tao of Story, as in The Way of Story. And I thought I'd get a grandiose big title, since this is Godzilla Summer. And size does matter. Well, here I'll be talking about the differences between a fairy tale, legend, myth, report, and also a favorite story, and their different characteristics and how they influence our lives in different ways. For example, these different types enter at different phases in transformation, and an understanding of how they work will help us, I think, hopefully, get through transformations more easily. They also give us a clue, an understanding of these different kinds of stories about how to deal with midlife and later life losses and the spirituality that can arise from that. Then the last talk on Monday will be on what I call elder tales, or stories about people who are called, quote, old in fairy tales. Now, fairy tales don't mention the actual age, but looking at judging, you know, when the kids were born and stuff like that, it appears to be anything over 40. But we have to remember some of these stories are very old, so they originated in times when people didn't live very long. Well, the stories I'll be telling you and discussing are folk tales, which means that they've been handed down over time. They're not literary fairy tales written by one person, like the fairy tales by Hans Christian Andersen or Oscar Wilde. The fairy tales written by individuals tend to reflect more the individual psychology than a universal one. If anyone's read Hans Christian Andersen, you know that some of the endings are a little peculiar, but apparently so was he. Whereas the folk tales are passed down over generations, and all the weird stuff or untrue stuff gets thrown out. It's a process of natural selection that leaves sort of like gems that have been polished over time with universal messages. What is striking is to find that different cultures have similar themes of midlife and later life. Because they're folk stories, I also want to emphasize that they belong to the folk, to all of us, which means there's no one right interpretation. These are not scriptures, which some people say have a one right interpretation. And, you know, people to tell you that. So your reactions and impressions would be just as important as mine. And I think you should figure out how the stories fit into your life or not. One thing I always remember to remind myself to remain humble is that, well, these stories have been around for thousands of years, and psychology and psychological interpretations are about 100 years old, and who knows where psychology will be in 1,000 years. So the stories will probably still be around when psychology is not. Well, let me move on to stories about midlife. I should mention how I found these stories. Coming from the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, I used a very high-tech approach. I camped out in different libraries and read through 5,000 fairy tales, actually more than that, and just picked out the ones with the adult as a protagonist rather than a child. The most familiar ones are about children or adolescents, like Cinderella or Snow White, but the ones about adults are quite different. I think one reason that stories are so powerful is summed up by a Hasidic saying, if you tell someone a fact, you reach their mind. If you tell them a story, you touch their soul. And that's what these stories are meant to do. Well, rather than go on about the stories, I thought I'd start by telling you one. This one is a story that comes from Iran, Persia, and it's called Stubborn Husband, Stubborn Wife. As you'll see, these stories are very accurate. Once upon a time, okay.
All right, how's this? Oh, okay. Size does matter. His microphone is as big as his podium. Once upon a time, there lived a husband and wife in a far-off country, namely Iran. Every morning, the wife would wake up. She'd get the water from the well, chop the wood, light the fire, sweep the floor, cook breakfast, and do the dishes and everything else. Meanwhile, her husband would get up, get dressed, eat breakfast, and then sit all day long on a bench outside. As you can imagine, the wife didn't appreciate this. Why don't you work like all the other men I know? My brother's work, my father's work, the husbands of my friends' work. And the husband said, well, I inherited a flock of sheep from my father and gave them to a shepherd to take care of, and the shepherd gives us meat, wool, and cheese, and that's enough. Besides, the ancient sages say, when a man speaks, the woman should obey, and I tell you, you should work, not me. Well, that's true, she said, but only when real men speak, not donkey droppings like you. And they argued. Well, one morning, the calf broke out of the barn because nobody had given the poor animal any food or water. So the wife said, well, why don't you take care of the animals? All the men I know take care of the animals. That's a man's job. My brothers do, my uncles, my father, my friends' husbands. And the husband said, oh, no, but my job is to sit here and think deep thoughts. As deep as a pigtail is long, she cried out, and they started another argument. Well, they would have argued all day and all night, except they both had the same idea at the same time. And it was fortunate that they had it at the same time, so they didn't argue over whose idea it was. They turned to each other and said, aha, let the first one who speaks from now be the one who has to take care of the animals. They nodded in silence, ate dinner in silence, and went to bed in silence. The next morning, the wife woke up, chopped the wood, lit the fire, got the water, cooked breakfast, swept the floor, did the laundry, while the husband sat outside thinking deep thoughts. And the wife knew if she stayed around seeing him do nothing, she would say something. So she decided to visit one of her friends. She put on her veil, this is a Muslim country now, and went off to visit one of her friends. The husband thought this was strange because she never went out so early and wondered what was going on. Then he thought, ah, I know what she's going to do. She's going to try to get a trick to make me to talk, but I'm too smart for her. No matter what kind of trick she comes up with, I won't speak. Even if heaven should fall to earth, I won't speak. Well, as he was sitting there thinking those deep thoughts, a beggar came up and asked for food or money, and the husband was about to offer him some when he caught himself. Aha, he told himself silently, this is a man my wife got to ask me for money, and she's probably around the corner waiting till I speak, but I'm too smart for her. So the husband said nothing and did nothing. The beggar asked several more times, then realized, oh, this poor man must be a deaf mute,
He went into the house to see if anybody else was there, and nobody was there, but gosh, look at all that cheese and meat and bread. So he ate everything and left. The husband was furious. Wait till I get hold of my wife. I will punish her for this stupidity. Well, as he was sitting there fuming, a barber came up. This was the days when barbers went from village to village. So he went up to the husband and asked if he wanted his beard trimmed and his hair trimmed. And the husband was about to say yes when he caught himself again. Well, my wife's first trick failed, so she's trying again, but I'm too smart for her. So he said nothing and did nothing. The barber asked several more times and then thought, oh, this poor man is a deaf mute, but it looks like he wants me to trim his beard and trim his hair. So the barber went ahead and did that, then motioned for some money. Well, the husband hadn't wanted his hair trimmed either, just wanted the beard, so he wasn't going to pay anything. So he said nothing and did nothing. The barber became angry, forgot he dealt with a deaf mute, and said, if you don't pay me, I'm going to cut off your beard completely and cut your hair so it looks funny. The husband said nothing, did nothing, so the barber cut off his beard and cut his hair so it looked funny. The husband was apoplectic. Wait till my wife gets back here. I will punish her for these foolish tricks. Well, the barber went away, and the husband kept sitting there thinking his deep thoughts, when an old woman came up. She was peddling cosmetics and secrets of beauty. She's the Islamic Avon lady. She had one problem, and that she was nearsighted. So she mistook the clean-shaven husband for a young woman sitting outside. And she hurried up to the husband and said, dear woman, what are you doing sitting outside without a veil? Have you no husband, no brother, no father to take care of you? Well, the husband almost laughed. My wife is going to such extreme lengths to get me to talk, but I'm too smart for her. The old woman asked several times, you mustn't sit outside without a veil, it is scandalous. Then she realized, oh, this poor lady must be a deaf mute, and so ugly too. Well, I can't help her with being deaf and mute, but I could help her with her appearance. So she got out... got out her wares, put on some rouge, lipstick, some powder, and then looked back and said, ooh, she should still wear a veil. Then she reached into his pocket, took all his money, and left. Now, the husband didn't know whether to scream with rage or to laugh. It was getting so ridiculous. So he just sat there and said nothing and did nothing. Then a man came up and thought, what is this funny-looking lady sitting outside without a veil? He was actually a thief by trade, and he thought it was strange a woman would sit outside without a veil and look so strange too. But strange things were often an opportunity for him to steal. So he went up and asked, dear lady, you mustn't sit outside. Why are you sitting out here without a veil? Have you no husband, no brother, no father to take care of you? The husband was about to say something and then caught himself. My wife is really getting desperate. She's trying these tricks again, but I won't speak. The burglar asked several more times and then thought, oh, this man is a deaf mute, or this woman is a deaf mute. So he went into the house to see if anybody was there. Nobody else was there, but there were these precious carpets, vases, and all sorts of things. He grabbed them all, stuck them in a huge bag. He always carried a bag to steal stuff. Put it on his back and left, waving happily to the deaf mute lady. The deaf mutes can't testify. The husband had to restrain himself from rolling on the floor laughing because he thought his wife was getting so desperate and she had all this work to do to bring back the stuff from wherever he was going to take it. Meanwhile, the wife was talking with one of her friends when the calf broke out of the barn because neither husband or wife had given him food or water and was running around the village square. The wife looked out the window and said, oh my goodness, that's our calf. What is my husband up to? I better go see. So she put on her veil, went outside, grabbed the calf, and went back home. My goodness, who is this woman sitting in front of my house? I've just been gone a few hours, and my husband takes another wife. I will put an end to this. So she went up to the husband and said, who are you, you brazen hussy, sitting outside my house without a veil? Aha! The husband leaped up. You spoke first. You have to take care of the animals from now on. What? It's you? Oh my God, you mean you shaved off your beard and put up makeup just to trick me? No, he said, it was those people you hired. What people, she asked. The people, you know, the barber and the beggar and the thief that you, within people you hired to act like them. What are you talking about? I didn't hire anybody. She stormed into the house. A moment later, she stormed out. Where is everything? And the husband said, don't try to make up stories. You know, you tried a trick and it didn't work. The wife stood there a moment and said, you mean you sat there and did nothing and said nothing while somebody ate everything and stole everything in our house? And the husband said, oh, don't make a scene. You have to take care of the animals from now on. You lost the wager. You're right, she said. I'll take care of the animals from now on because I'm leaving. I don't want a husband as silly and stupid and stubborn as you. Goodbye. So she took the cast and left. Well, as you can see, stories about midlife are very long and complicated. But then so is midlife. But the first thing she did was to go to the village square and ask the children playing there if they'd seen a man with a huge bag on his back. They all nodded and pointed, and in the distance on the desert dunes, she could see a man hurrying away with a big bag on his back. So she thought a moment, then fastened her veil more tightly, grabbed the calf, and set out after the thief. She caught up with him when he was resting at an oasis and sat across the spring from him and started sighing and batting her eyelashes because she had come up with a plan. Well, the thief soon noticed that and then struck up a conversation. What are you doing all alone in the middle of a desert with a calf? Have you no husband, a brother, and a father to take care of you? And she said, oh, if I did, would I be alone in the desert with just a calf? Well, the two then started traveling together, and she kept sighing and batting her eyelashes until the thief proposed that they get married. Oh, yes, she said, I do need a strong man like you. Let's get married in the next village, and the chief there can marry us, because she knew it was too late in the day for the ceremony. So when they arrived there, they asked the village chief to marry them, and he said, oh, gladly, but it has to be tomorrow. But I have two extra rooms, so you could stay here tonight and have dinner with me. So they all had dinner, and everybody went to bed, and everybody went to sleep, except the wife. She waited till everyone was snoring, then tiptoed into the thief's room, looked into the bag, confirmed that it was all her stuff, picked up the bag, put it on her calf, and started off. Then she stopped, tiptoed back into the house, got a little cup and candle, and lit the candle, and poured some flour and water in the cup and cooked it. Then she poured the dough in the thief's shoes and in the shoes of the village chief. Then she smiled and left. The next morning, the thief woke up, and the first thing he noticed was his loot was gone. The second thing he noticed was his fiancée was missing. And there, outside in the window on the desert dunes, he could see her walking away with a calf and this big bag on the calf. He screamed bloody murder, grabbed his shoes, but his feet wouldn't go in because the dough had hardened like rock. So he threw his shoes away, grabbed the village chief's shoes, but they wouldn't fit either. So he ran barefoot after the woman. But by this time, the sun had risen, so the desert sands were boiling hot, and he could just run a few yards before his feet started to get blistered. All he could do was sit down and shake his hand at the woman as she vanished over the horizon. Well, as she was walking, she decided she would go home. Don't ask me why, this is what the story says. So she ran home to her house and was shocked to find her husband wasn't sitting on the bench outside. Oh my gosh, she said, something bad must have happened to him. He's always sitting outside. So she rushed into the house. The husband wasn't there, but the fire was cooking. Somebody had chopped wood. Somebody had gotten water. Somebody had made something to eat. And then she rushed into the courtyard in the house, and there she found her husband hanging the laundry. What are you doing? She said, that is woman's work, as she took it from him. And when the husband saw her, he burst into tears, ran and embraced her and said, after you left, I realized how stupid and stubborn I was. I lost my fortune, my family, and my faith. Well, they then came to an agreement so that both of them worked and the husband took care of the animals like all, you know, brothers and husbands and uncles supposed to do. Then after they both worked all day, they sat together outside on the bench, watching the world go by and thinking deep thoughts together. Well, it's quite different from Cinderella and Snow White. Any reactions or thoughts initially? The story starts off with the traditional patriarchal marriage where the husband thinks he can tell his wife what to do and she doesn't quite agree with that. Then there's this sharp role reversal where she goes out on this adventure and outwits the thief and comes back with her belongings. She essentially does what the young hero does in fairy tales about young people. So she does something heroic, whereas the husband ends up looking with makeup and hanging the laundry, taking the feminine role. So they switch sides. Jung was probably the first to notice that this was a normal event for men and women at midlife, at least those raised in a traditional way. Men had to come to terms with their feminine side, their emotions, intuitions, the need for relationship, and women had to reclaim their assertiveness, independence, and adventurous spirit. And since he made this comment, well, quite independently, a study at University of California, Berkeley, followed some students from sixth grade or earlier to now in their 80s, and found that, this pattern that Jung had observed, that boys often were very sensitive and aesthetic and emotional when they're young, but come 10, 11, 12, that all disappeared and they started doing the usual macho stuff. On the other hand, girls were often independent, outspoken, said what they felt, and went after what they wanted, until 10, 11, 12, when they started to act dumb and fit stereotypes. Well, what the researchers found was that at midlife, the boys or the men who had been sensitive as young boys started reclaiming these things, artistic activities or emotional things, and conversely, the women who had been really outspoken started their own careers. And this research showed that those who did that did better as they aged, and the people who didn't, who stayed with the traditional roles and didn't switch, didn't do so well. Of course, now there's a lot of research on girls and how they are silenced or give up their self in adolescence and how the task is for women to reclaim that. The same thing happens to boys, but in a different way. That doesn't make sense, does it? The same thing happens to boys, but in a different way. Never mind. someone had a humorous comment in one of the workshops I gave and said, well, you know, the people who come up to the husband are significant. You have a beggar, a barber, the old woman who sells things, and then a thief. Because in most relationships, you beg, barter, steal things from each other so that you can get your needs met. Well, it's quite interesting that folk tales also show another pattern besides this role reversal. If men grow up as sensitive and, you know, aesthetic and emotional in fairy tales, their task is to reclaim their heroic side. And conversely, for women in fairy tales who are like the reigning queen or a powerful figure, they have to come to terms with their vulnerability and need for relationships. So the basic reversal is whatever you didn't attend to in youth comes in back at midlife and says, here I am. Another element in this story, which is actually I found horrifying as I was reading them, coming across them, was that men have a very difficult time. I mean, this poor husband is humiliated, and as we'll see, that is a theme throughout many other stories. Fortunately, there are also other stories that show what happens afterwards, and that's what I'll be talking about tomorrow. On men's spirituality. There's another important point here in that this story is humorous. In fact, it's probably better than a lot of sitcoms on TV. If you think about stories about young people like Cinderella or Snow White, they're not very funny. They're more, you know, heartwarming or touching. They're actually kind of serious because they deal with serious things, fighting a dragon and stuff like that. And this, I think the folktales here are giving us an important message that humor is an important part of dealing with midlife and later. And actually, some longitudinal studies, this time at Harvard, showed that that was true following a group of Harvard students before World War II up till now in their 70s, and found that the ones who did better as they got older used humor more and more, and the ones who got into lots of problems used humor less and less. And of course, Freud thought that humor was the most mature or highest defense mechanism. Any thoughts, questions, comments? Yes.
Alan said that when there is a role reversal with men and women, as Will said in the story, that men and women did well, what does that mean?
The question was, in the research, when there was this role reversal, what did it mean that they did well? It meant that they had high ratings of life satisfaction, and they didn't have problems like with depression or multiple psychosomatic illnesses that the people who didn't do the reversal had, and a wider circle of friends and rather than social isolation. Right there.
From the perspective these days where young women are very professionally oriented and they're being commonly what the male role was. I mean, they're supporting themselves, they're owning homes, you know, they're no longer the mother of the household being submissive.
Yeah, that's the point was that women today, young women today, are doing the traditional heroic stuff early on, not doing the submissive female bit. And that's why the other stories are important, where they do show like the reigning queen or a conquering queen having to come to terms with her vulnerable side. And many career women do come up against that, especially around the issue of children or family. Yes?
When you talk about a sense of humor, my mother said that when my children were born, she would give them three gifts. She was a fairy godmother. And the first gift was the ability to see that there were two sides to every question, sometimes three or four or five. The second gift was a sense of humor. And she said, with two gifts like this, you're never going to achieve much, but you will have a lot of friends and you will have a good time. The third gift was, when you get older, you will achieve a new detachment.
The comment was her mother, when she had children, gave three gifts like the fairy godmother to the children. And the first was the ability to see more than one side in any issue. And the second was a sense of humor. And she made the comment, and the third was when you get older, you have an amused detachment, or you wouldn't be overwrought by difficulties.
And she said, you'll never achieve much, but you'll have a lot of friends and you'll have a good life.
Now, another way to explore the fairy tale would be to put yourself in it. So we might do a little exercise right now, if you want to just close your eyes a second and picture yourself as the husband sitting on the bench. Your beard was shaven off, and you have makeup on your face, but you refuse to talk because you're going to win this wager. And just get a sense of what feelings come up as you are that husband. Then ask yourself, where in your life have you been this stubborn husband, or where are you now doing that? You might make a few mental notes about that. And then picture yourself as the wife in the middle of the desert pursuing the thief, wanting to get back all her belongings, knowing that the thief could be quite dangerous. And just picture yourself pulling along the calf. You see the oasis where the thief is with all your belongings. What feelings come up? Images? Reactions. Can we wait? And then ask yourself, where in your life has someone stolen something that you had to go after? And what did you do? How did you get it back? And just make a few mental notes about that, and you can open your eyes. And now comes the fun part. Turn to somebody next to you and tell them what came up, if you feel comfortable with it. It'll take about 5 minutes. Has everybody had a chance to share if they wanted to? Why don't you take a couple of minutes to finish up? Well, any questions or comments about the story or what came up with the exercises?
Yes.
I like that the man, I think that men really aren't going to be liberated until they can laugh at themselves. And I like when you said he one reason he didn't do anything is he saw the humor as being different. And I felt like he enjoyed it. And that's the other reason he didn't do anything, not because of his wife and the bed. But also, I thought that the old man didn't just sit on the porch to win the bet. He also liked the experience of being different. In a way, he was thinking, he was acting out deep thoughts while he was waiting for the deep thoughts. They showed up, and I felt like, oh, and he really liked what was happening. He laughed about it, and that's why he didn't speak, not just because of his bet.
I think that's a good point, that if he took this seriously, this would have been a terrible, horrible thing for him. But if he could laugh at it, it's not. And actually, we'll see that that's a key part of men's spirituality tomorrow. Yes?
Didn't this role reversal business have a lot to do with the social atmosphere of the times, for example, pre-war, World War II, post-World War II, where women during the war found out that they could really handle men's jobs because they took over the home front of men's jobs and they were fulfilling their masculinity, realizing their masculinity within themselves. And then when the men came home, all of a sudden they had to give all this up. The men can take the jobs back, and there was a lot of resentment.
I think that's a good point, that certainly for Americans, present generations, that was a key factor. But the role reversals are visible in cultures around the world. For example, David Goodman, a gerontologist, studied the Christian Jews in Lebanon and found exactly this kind of reversal, as well as among some a Navajo tribe. And of course, historically, that's been true too in ancient China. When the husband and wife got older, the woman took over the clan, basically. And similar things that happened would be in England, where typically a man would run a business and then die. Then the wife would take over and make it much bigger. Yes.
The thing that I found interesting, this is something that I've had to come to grips with, I like what the young lady said over here about the career woman. I've always been a career woman, rather assertive and so on. But the fact that the woman in addressing her husband initially addressed him honestly, open with reason, and got nowhere. When she went after the thief, she batted her eyes, and soft and feminine, got exactly what she wanted. And by the thief, was able to succeed. Because she comes back to her husband. And what had happened is the very things that we don't like in ourselves often as women succeeded, where the very thing that didn't work was the male cut.
That's a good point.
Uh-huh.
That brings up some interesting points about women's heroism in these fairy tales. Usually it does involve cleverness, because obviously they can't fight someone who's physically stronger, so they have to rely on wit. Pejoratively, that's called woman's wiles, but it'd be actually wisdom. I mean, it's pretty smart to put the dough in the shoes. I mean, who would have thought of that? And the second point is that women, when they go out on a heroic quest, don't go out to take somebody else's treasure like the typical young male hero does. They go out to get what was taken from them. So it's a restorative thing rather than a conquering thing. It's quite interesting to see that throughout different cultures. Any further questions or comments, or shall I... You have a calf?
Why
the calf? Well, that's a good question. There are certain the social cultural context. It couldn't be a pig because it's a Muslim country. And presumably the husband gave the sheep to the shepherd, like you said. And I don't know if you keep goats a lot, so that leaves a calf. Also, there's a line in the I Ching that's kind of interesting. Care of the calf brings good fortune, and it refers to taking care of your the vulnerable side, the needy side, because a calf is very dependent.
A child is
like a child. The calf could be a child.
Yeah.
which often triggers arguments between parents.